Today's episode is brought to you by Oak Tree Products, the ultimate one-stop shop for audiologists, hearing professionals, and sound professionals. If you're looking for diagnostic or screening equipment, this is the place for you. From the essentials to the hard-to-find tools, Oak Tree has you covered. We've personally been ordering from them for years, and they've always come through. We recently just ordered new diagnostic equipment for four offices through Oak Tree.
During the pandemic, when supplies were hard to come by and everything was up in the air, Oak Tree kept things in stock and moving. They've handled supply chain disruptions, tariff uncertainty, all of it without missing a beat. Whether you're outfitting a new practice or just need to stock up, check them out at oaktreeproducts.com. Again, that's oaktreeproducts.com. We will link to them in the episode description and tell them we sent you when you visit oaktreeproducts.com.
We're joined by someone whose sound you've definitely heard, whether you've realized it or not. Fabian Chavez is the powerhouse saxophonist currently touring with the Jonas Brothers, bringing his fierce energy to massive stages across the world. But Fabian's musical footprint extends far beyond the arena stage. He's recorded for Tyler, the Creator's Grammy-winning album, Call Me If You Get Lost, and he's also worked with an incredible list of artists, both live and in studio, including Usher, Mac Miller, David Foster, and many more. Beyond being an extraordinary performer, Fabian is a musician who deeply understands the science of sound, how to shape it, how to control it, and how to protect the ears that make his career possible. We're excited to dig into his journey from his early musical roots to the biggest stages of the world, what life really looks like on tour, and the realities of hearing health for today's working musicians. Fabian, welcome to Hear Us Out. Thank you for coming on today.
Yeah, you got it. Thank you for having me. Glad to be on.
Let's start from the beginning. What drew you to saxophone in the first place? And when did you realize you wanted to pursue this professionally? How did you get started?
Totally. Yeah. So I guess the story is like I had been, you know, playing music my entire life, baby, since I was a baby. My dad and all his, you know, family play music and were very interested in music. My grandparents sang in church and played music in church. And I did too, you know, growing up. So that was like my first experience. They all had like, they had a family band and traveled and played gigs around Southern California and things like this, you know. So I would always go and hang out and, you know, go to sound checks and be at the rehearsals and, you know, the whole thing. So early on, that was my exposure. It was like, you know, just music constantly traveling and that sort of thing. So I definitely naturally gravitated toward it at a young age. My parents could see, oh, he's got like a, you know, a gift, a knack for it. You know, like things came easier to me than maybe like other kids, you know, musically. So then, yeah, I had been playing drums that whole time and even gotten some percussion lessons on, you know, congas. And then when I turned 12, I wanted to join the middle school band, you know, sixth grade middle school band. So the teacher actually drew out of a hat, you know, maybe like 20 kids wanted to play drums, percussion, but only four spots were available, you know? So she chose out of a hat. I didn't get chosen. And I was like, oh man, I was really bummed. Told my mom, and my mom like even, you know, communicated with the band director and said, hey, you know, my son's been playing for a while. I really think, you know, he really wants to play drums. I just, you know, and the teacher was like, well, he's been playing so long and he like already can like play. He's going to be bored out of his mind doing drums. She's like, I recommend he still play drums and percussion, but learn another instrument, like a wind instrument, you know, that way he can do both at the same time. And incidentally, this is so cool. This kind of matches up with the story, but my mom would always listen to Kenny G growing up. You know, that was always on. Mm-hmm. I just Christmas albums, non-Christmas albums, like from the get-go, I always heard Kenny G. I actually just met him and we played with him just this past week.
That's
so
awesome.
It was really cool to tell him that, like, hey, you are the reason I play saxophone. So yes, long story short, Kenny G and my mom's influence made me pick up saxophone and I just found my voice on it. And I was like, yeah, this is it. You know, playing drums, but sax is like my...
Do you think your understanding of rhythm from playing the drums benefited you when it came to playing sax?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I've gotten this comment a few times where other musicians will say like, man, you got like such a percussive thing about you, you know, and then when they find out later that I play drums, they're like, that makes total sense that like you're playing, your saxophone playing reflects that of a percussionist or a drummer, you know what I mean? So, yeah.
I've heard that from Dave Grohl, that when he's playing guitar, like he actually thinks about it like playing rhythm on the drum kit, because that's kind of his roots as well. So it's an interesting idea of how drums can really be foundational for other instruments.
Absolutely, man. Absolutely. And vice versa as well. You know, if you're going from a melodic instrument to playing drums, your approach could be way different than, you know, a normal drummer would approach the drums. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I think it does help me on both too. You know, again, when I play drums or percussion, I do have, maybe I think about things melodically as opposed to a drummer might not think about it melodically.
Mm-hmm. How is it for you recording in studio versus live in terms of how you go about playing? Do you go all out in studio? Do you tone it down, make it a little bit more tame versus in concert where you kind of have to give it your all every single time?
Yeah, it's always like interesting to find a good balance. Because with recordings, obviously you want to like put it all out there and you want to like give your best effort. But you do want to leave a little bit of like juice for when, you know, you are live. And I think naturally just things, you know, when you're surrounded by a band and you're, you know, feeling things live, hearing things live, you respond differently than you would just listening to a track. You know what I mean? That being said, yeah, I think, you know, things are more polished in the studio. But me personally, like, I do try to give it my all, like, especially on the solos and things like that, you know, of my own records personally. You know, I put out 4 singles now. I'm putting out a 5th one soon. So it's been really cool learning about just the recording process and how far should I take it? Mm-hmm. How clean should I make it? You know, do I leave a little bit of the like kind of gritty, raw, maybe a little flub here and there because it is natural. It is what happens. Yeah. Or do I like polish it and make it super radio, you know? So I don't know. I'm kind of like discovering the balance, you know, like I said earlier, just the balance of like, you know, of what makes me feel good. I definitely love a raw live edge to my records. I want it to feel like, oh man, these guys are like in it. So yeah. And my tendency is to just kind of give it my all no matter what, in any situation I'm in. So I try not to like hold back too much or like play it safe, I guess.
In all the different collaborations you've done, do you ever find it a challenge to find creative space for yourself within, I'll say, somebody else's music where they're bringing you in to play? Is that ever a challenge, either not stepping on toes or feeling like you're getting to do what you think a song needs?
Yeah, I don't think it's a challenge. Well, it is a challenge in that, you know, you have to recognize that in that situation, it's not about me. They are maybe depending on my musical decisions and my musical choices, so to speak. Like, they're depending on that. That's why they hired me. However, you know, my one job when someone's hiring me as like a sideman or a supportive musician is to support them and make them sound the best and cater to the music the way that they want me to, first and foremost. If they give me the liberty to, hey, take a solo or, hey, you know, interpret that melody however you want, like that's your, you know, or whatever, then absolutely, you know, I'll definitely take it. Yeah, and even just like live and in a live setting with the Jonas Brothers, for example, our job is to support them and make them look good and sound good and feel good. And so that's just all I'm trying to do.
How on earth did you get connected to the Jonas Brothers? I don't even know how one does get connected to going on tour with them.
I know, right? It's a funny story. Well, I met the piano player, Michael Wooten, who's currently playing now. We did like a small gig, you know, like in LA, you know, kind of, you know, a gig that I would say is just, you know, a Friday night, like, bar kind of situation, just like, you know. But I knew that the artist, the singer, he gets really, really good musicians all the time. Like, I've always loved playing in his bands, and anytime I get to play with him, his name is Maurice Smith, shout out. You know, yeah, he always gets great musicians, you know. And so I knew it's going to be totally fun, you know, like, this gig, you know. And I always tell this story as, like, give it your all, and you never know who's watching, you never know who's there. Always perform your best, always be on your game. Yeah, Michael really didn't even mention the Jonas Brothers thing. One thing led to another in the search for a tenor player. And a week later, after I met Michael for the first time, and our one experience was just playing that one night and hanging, he texted me like a week later. I was like, hey, we're looking for a tenor sax player to go on the Jonas Brothers tour with us for the next 6 months. You know, are you down for that? And I was like, oh my God, yeah. Then I talked with Chase, the MD, and we really clicked, and that's kind of how that happened. No audition. But one thing I think I will comment on is Michael was saying, like, ability to, like, play in front of and feel and, like, play in front of people, even if it was, like, 10 people that weren't even hardly paying attention, you can kind of have that discernment and see like, oh, like he's going to be amazing on stage, mm-hmm. or like this person's going to work really well on stage because they're so willing to give it all, or, you know, like not just go on autopilot because, oh, there's only whatever people here are.
Yeah, we've heard from other artists where they could play a club show in front of 150 people or a private event, or they can play a festival in front of 60,000, and they actually find that club show to almost be more intimidating. That with the huge crowd, there's so many people that you're not necessarily interacting with the individuals when you're on stage mm-hmm. in that big stadium setting. But in the club, you are seeing those people. You're seeing their reaction to your work and your sound. Can you mm-hmm. talk about from your perspective if you have a preference for Yankee Stadium versus the LA Club or something in between?
Yeah, I mean, I just love big things. So I'm going to say that like that feeling of doing a Yankee Stadium or a big, you know, festival where there is, you know, 60, 80,000 people, like it is a feeling that like it's hard to replicate or just understand, like, oh, these people are staring at us right now. When I do think about it, I've been on stage a few times and been like, wow, this is kind of crazy. Like there's just thousands and thousands of people just mm-hmm. staring at us playing music on stage. So it is like a weird thing. I can't say that I've done a lot of the smaller stuff and, you know, obviously only have really, experience with like these giant festivals, you know, just in the last few years really, and our giant arenas, our venues. And so, you know, I love that feeling. I do love the pressure of live. It is kind of a good thing that kind of keeps you on your toes. But depending on the setting, you don't feel as much pressure because you're playing a lesser of a role. So it just kind of depends in the role that I'm playing in that space. If I'm leading it, then I'm probably a little bit more nervous.
Correct me if I'm wrong. I think you've been with the Jonas Brothers since their previous tour in 2023. So Yankee Stadium was your first with them. My first Jonas Brothers concert was at Yankee Stadium the second night. It was a much larger spectacle than I ever expected. I thought that it was just going to be the three of them on their guitars. And it was this show for 3.5 hours. Can you talk about what that was for you? Because I didn't expect that. There were dancers and all the musicians were dancing too. What was that for you? That's as big as you can possibly dive in at Yankee Stadium.
That whole experience at the very beginning of that was very surreal. Only because I had really gotten the call maybe a month before that first show. You know,
had you ever listened to a single Jonas Brothers song before that? Because that's a lot to learn.
Yes, I definitely have heard and listened to music. I wasn't like a deep dive Jonas Brothers fan. No, I was definitely familiar with some of their work. Definitely the popular ones, Sucker, SOS, Burn It Up, and the newer ones too. You know, Nick's stuff. Yeah, it was a lot. It was a lot. It's not much time to prepare just all the music, memorizing it, because you got to also remember the theme of last year's tour was 5 albums, 1 night, right? So that was all their albums in 1 night, all songs. Essentially, that was the play. It was like, we're going to do all of our music. And at some point, whether it was in like a little acoustic version or in a medley, they really did touch every song. So it was like upwards of 70 songs that we had to memorize, blocking on stage and choreography on stage. Things would change. We'd have a guest artist here. The set list would change right before. So it was a lot to memorize. And I remember actually in between, the horns wouldn't play for every song, but in between, you know, where the horns would be off, we'd have like an iPad for like our music and an iPad for like our stage direction. And we'd be like, okay, we're going to do this for the next few songs. Okay, we're good. You know, and then we'd run out there and do it. And we're like, okay, let's go back and got to refresh. So it was a lot of pressure. And I'll never forget, you know, I've told the story a bunch of times, but just being out there that first night, When the band stepped out, like, it was just roaring. And then when the bros stepped out, it was just, I mean, a deafening scream. And that was like the moment where I was like, whoa, like, this is insane. We're like at Yankee Stadium about to play a show. Like, what is happening?
In your in-ear feed, when you're on stage, are you getting some of that direction of notes from the mixing table or any sort of guidance, if there's any changes or anything like that? And are you all wearing mics to communicate on stage?
So we are, mainly the direction we get on stage. There are a few talkback mics, and our musical director Chase is actually not, he doesn't stay on stage with us and play with us. He's definitely music director, but he is so important in all aspects of the teams. You know, he's in constant communication with the front of house, with the lighting team, with playback, and all these different departments on pyro that he has to communicate with instantly. Say something changes, or Nick says, "Oh, we're gonna skip this song," or "We're gonna add this song." So there are three talkback mics on stage. That one is close to Nick, one is close to Joe, and then there's another one for the band if something goes wrong. Oh, I broke a strap, or my string broke, or whatever. And other than that, yeah, where there's not much talking going on. I mean, obviously, like, everyone's kind of in their zone, so try not to disrupt that flow as much as possible. But yeah, there have definitely been audibles, and Nick will say something or tell a funny joke. But we don't have mics. Yeah, we're not wearing mics to cue each other on stage.
This is my favorite question to ask musicians who are on the podcast. Can you tell us about a time where something may have gone wrong during a show and how either you or the people around you have dealt with that?
Ooh, trying to think.
Or you get lucky and everything is seamless always.
No, I'm sure there have been some weird things along the way. One thing that stands out to me, it's not really a musical situation, but it was a situation on stage where part of the stage was like on fire for a second, but the pyro had set off some of the things, and one of the, not any of us, but one of the pyro guys goes up there and he's, you know, fire extinguishing, and everyone's like, woo, clapping.
They might have,
yeah, a little bit. But yeah, honestly, everything, there haven't been too many crazy musical things.
Does it feel like a well-oiled machine from the inside that you've gotten into something that is just, it just knows how to operate?
Man, I would say yes. I would say yes, mainly because of the people and the personnel that are in the band. Tyler on bass, Ginger on guitar, Jack on drums, Daniel on guitar, Michael on keys, and then our background singers, Kellyanne and Mark, and then the horns. Everybody obviously plays their own role, but especially this tour so much, we've been having to learn a ton of songs, mainly the core band, because we've had guests almost at every single show along the way, you know, and we play their most popular song a lot of times, or one that them and the Jonas Brothers have made together. And it could be oftentimes the day before or even day of, hey, we're going to play this song. And they got to learn this song perfectly to play in front of 20,000 people. And they kill it every time. It really is. It amazes me how they just nail it. And the horns have a lesser of a role in those situations. But when we do, we played with Kenny G. We played along with him and had a little moment. Yeah, I just think it's the band is really done. They do their homework and they're very, very good at what they do. And I think that trust within the band of, okay, we all got it. We can all kind of, someone's got a little bit better. So like, they'll cue something or they'll make something very obvious or whatever. Yeah, everybody does their homework and really shines in that way of making it feel comfortable on stage.
Sounds like it's a very professional environment.
Yeah, yeah. Very clear for us. Our MD, so yeah.
The way that I found you in the first place was I was watching a YouTube video of Vacation Eyes from MetLife. And
nice.
I guess Samsung TV had done a close-up of you doing your solo. Can you talk about how that solo came to be? Because it was definitely, however, Vacation Eyes was definitely changed from last tour to this tour in the way that it now has the key change. You have a whole different solo than maybe you did previously. Can you tell us how that came to be and how did you come up with that solo? Did they give you direction on what they wanted you to do? Tell us about that.
And if you can't tell, she's a big fan.
I love it. I love it.
One of us knows more about the Jonas Brothers than the other.
So that, I mean, that was like a moment that did happen last year. It's funny, or 2 years ago, rather. But it was different in the way that there was a sax solo, but at the same time, it was just kind of like a vamp out, and it was like a dance. Now, we were doing some dance moves at the end, two-stepping, and Nick was kind of doing some fills, some vocal ad-libs in between, but nothing too in your face. And I remember they'd be like, the previous tour, Nick was like, oh, you can do some sax fills there. And then the sax fills turned into a little bit more, and then when we were doing this tour and coming up for the blocking and everything, we were just like, oh yeah, Fabian's got a solo, right? And the choreographer was like, oh, then you got to go out there. It's your solo, bro. Go out there. Like, so now it's a moment. Now we're just walk all the way down and hang out with Joe at the very end. So that's kind of how that came to be. And the brothers were just great. You know, that's cool. And I look forward to doing that all the time. So it's really fun.
It's one of the songs that is consistently played show to show. They switch it up, but that one is a constant.
Yeah, and then the arrangement on is beautiful. The really nice jazz intro, that these really nice chord changes, and then it kind of settles into the song, and It's got some hits. You know, I remember Joe, I was like, oh, let's put these hits in there. Bah, bah. So there's like little arrangements, and that's all for the guys. Chase will facilitate the ideas and show how to musically do it, but it's all from them. You know, that's all their recommendations.
You talked earlier about your upbringing and the influence church had on you musically, and you've spoken about Kenny G and his influence. Mm-hmm. Are there other musicians that have had a significant influence on you? Because we don't always think about sax as part of rock or pop, even though there's some really large acts that had a very significant sax component. For me, I think of Bruce Springsteen and Clarence. I think of Billy Joel's band. I think of Dave Matthews Band with horns, yeah. OAR with horns. Who is it that's influenced you as well, or kind of informed your rock pop perspective?
Yeah, it's so funny because maybe I'm a bad, or I'm just a West Coaster. I wasn't a big Billy Joel, Bruce Springsteen guy growing up. Like my dad had me listening to like James Taylor and Earth, Wind & Fire, Kool & the Gang, Stevie Wonder, some salsa music and Latin jazz music. You know, we listened to Boncho Sanchez, who's like this very big Latin jazz artist. And, you know, that funk, soul, R&B, Americana, you know, listening to Carole King and, you know, stuff like that too. That was like a very big part of my influence, I think vocally too, because I think when I play saxophone, I'm thinking, I always try to a human voice. Mm. I always try to mimic a singer. And I try to phrase things and just make it sound as human as possible, because that to me is where it touches me. That kind of humanness to an instrument. My girlfriend's from New York and her dad loves Bruce Springsteen. And I always hear like these names, Clarence Clemons. And, you know, and I was like, they're amazing. And I will never like say they don't belong, like, because they totally shaped the sound of the saxophone and have their huge landmarks in the world of saxophone and rock and pop saxophone. But yeah, like even like Lenny Pickett from Tower of Power was like a huge one. That style of saxophone playing, very like big, abrasive, very rhythmic.
Yes.
High sounds, you know, like high notes. And even more so now, because I try to like be as transparent in each genre as I can. If I'm playing a rock, pop, slow ballady thing, like I probably won't be playing all crazy jazz stuff. I'm going to play just like long notes, you know, like on a solo you'd hear from Kirk Whalum on I Will Always Love You. He's almost just playing the melody, but it just sounds so good.
Just the timing
Yeah, the timing, the feeling, the notes, how he's approaching the notes. So many details on how to like get that, to emote, to get that emotion across.
Can you tell us a bit about what it's like out on the road? When we talk to other musicians, there's always the component of it feels glitzy and glamorous. And then there's always but it's not only positive. There are some challenges to it. Can you talk a little bit about that for us?
Yeah, definitely. I think first is just as anybody who travels a lot, it does wear on you after a while, especially luckily we don't do planes that much. We will jump on planes every now and again to maybe we have a few days home or we have to get to another gig pretty quick or whatever the case is. And those tend to be long days because you get there early, you got to wait, and then you get to your thing, and then you got to wait to take off, then you have your flight, and then you got to wait to get off, then you got to wait for your bags, and you got to Uber to the thing, and it gets to become a lot. And if there's a couple stops, one or two stops, and then you're just like, oh my gosh. You
know,
we had a travel day the other day that was just, it was an entire day. Flights got delayed, and we're just like sitting there, just like, my goodness, you know, this is an 8, 9, 10 hour thing. Those aren't the funnest days. And sometimes when we're on the bus, let's say it's 4 a.m, we get there and everybody has to get off the bus because the buses are not going to stay at the at the hotel. They're going to drop us off. You got to get your bags and you got to go. So it's like, man, you know, I went 12 and now I have to wake up at 3 to get off the bus, then to go back to bed.
That's right.
And those are just logistical things. Yeah. That, you know, you get used to, and luckily the band is very lucky because our day starts a little bit later than crew, for example. Crew's got to be there setting up at the wee hours of the night. They're amazing, and what they do, it's insane. Those guys work so, so incredibly hard. Guys and girls work so incredibly hard, and they're amazing. But yeah, luckily our day starts a little bit later, so we do have time to rest up, shower up, eat up, coffee, whatever we need to do, get to the venue. And there's catering. Jonas Brothers Tour, they do take care of us. And any chance they get to have a masseuse or a chiropractor or a barber or puppies, any little thing to kind of just bring us a little bit of joy, something to show us that, hey, we see you, we care, like trying to do the best we can. They really do make it as easy as they can for us, despite all the logistical challenges.
People are taking time away from their families and their homes and other jobs, that it takes its toll and it's a long commitment. So I can imagine that it gets very draining.
I mean, that is the other aspect of it. The other component too is missing someone. For example, I wasn't dating anybody last tour. You know? So I was like, cool, I'm just out here. Like, we can go as long as you want. But now is I am dating someone, you know, that I love very much and I'm very serious about. You know? And it's like, it's really hard to be out when, you know, when you want to be with someone. It does take a lot of commitment to make it through this time, and it is challenging, but thank God she's come out a lot, you know. Mm-hmm. And also they're very welcoming of, you know, significant others and family, you know. Anytime they come out, you know, we try to make it work as far as like having them there at the venue and, you know, like just having them feel at home. We understand that this is a long process, it's a long time to be out, so whatever we can do to, you know, help you not miss your family.
Yeah.
So, yeah, luckily my girlfriend's come out a lot, and that's helped just to even physically be with them, even if it's for a couple days, a few mm-hmm. days at a time.
Yeah, because it sounds like it's a very professionally run operation that's taking into account the people that are doing the work. And
yeah,
I think a lot of times fans of a band or fans of musicians, they see the end product. They see you up on stage, they hear your solo, they hear your music, but there's not a recognition of the process. There's not a recognition of the grind of being on tour. There's not a recognition of all the years you spent learning and practicing and playing the small clubs before you're at Yankee Stadium. Can you talk a little bit about, for you now, being a part of something so big, what that means to you musically?
I feel so proud that I get to do this. I know mm-hmm. that not everybody gets the opportunity to do this, and I never take it for granted. I just try to do the best I possibly can at all times, and not only musically, but just personally. I want to make others feel safe and you know, and that they can be themselves, and they don't have to, like, you know, walk on eggshells. Like, also that component of being a cool person and a cool hang is super mm-hmm. important to be when being on the road, that it's almost more important than playing, you know, because there mm-hmm. are a ton of amazing players, but being personable, being easy to work with, being responsible, those are really amazing attributes that add up to the whole total sum of everyone's happiness. You know what I mean? If we're always constantly waiting on someone, or it does wear on you after a while.
And from what I've seen, it looks like you genuinely enjoy being on stage. That it's not you're doing it for the paycheck. It's like you look like you're enjoying what you're doing and the opportunity you have in front of everybody.
1,000%. 1,000%, man. Even the other day, it was a rough travel day. It was a long day. It was like 2 days in a row, or sometimes we even had 4 show days in a row, you know? Mm-hmm. And on the fourth one, everyone was just kind of like, oh my gosh. But as soon as we get on stage, it's just like your attitude, the way you feel, everything completely shifts because you're feeling people's energy, you're seeing people's energy, you're seeing people's smiles. Nothing matters in that moment. Like, it's just being present on stage is like the best thing possible.
Maybe this answers my question, because something I've wondered for everybody involved, it's really for any musician that goes on tour, of how do you keep it fun when it's the same songs night after night? I can't imagine that how do they still love playing the year 3000? Because they've been doing it for 20 years. But even you, who's been doing it every night for the past few months, and even from the previous tour, and you have to look fresh, because even though you guys have been doing it night after night, the people who are in front of you in the audience is there for a show. So you have to make it seem like it's fun for you. How do you keep it fresh when it's the same songs on repeat?
When you're sharing something special with someone for the first time, I mean, a lot of these fans we have seen multiple times, but obviously a majority of these people are seeing the show for the first time, or they saw the show when they were 10. My last time at Jonas Brothers show, I was 10 years old, 30 now, you know, I saw it 20 years ago. And just connecting with someone, I think, obviously, you know, as a performer, we do connect with people in the crowd, and we'll lock eyes with someone. And you'll have a moment where they're just so genuinely happy. They're just singing at the top of their lungs. And for you to just be on the receiving end of that and to facilitate it and help it along, mm-hmm. there's no better feeling than that's just the interaction. I think that's the beautiful thing. Obviously, I love Jonas Brothers music now at this point. Like, I've got every single song, you know, just floating through my head. And really, I mean, I love their music, especially the Speeding From Your Hometown album. The album, the one previous one, that was I mean, one of my favorites, top to bottom. And I think we all consider ourselves very lucky to do this. And I think that the crew, the band knows what it takes to perform. And I don't think we're ever going to get tired of it. We may be physically tired, but in our hearts, we love doing this every single time, or else we wouldn't be doing it.
Was there a time that you felt you've connected personally with somebody in the audience, a fan, Jonas Brothers, or outside of that, where you feel like you have connected with a fan, or they have made it known to you of how much your music has meant to them?
Oh, so much. I get a lot of DMs about, my God, like the horns are my, just giving so much energy the whole time, or thank you for singing with me at this moment, you know, like, you know, or thank you for smiling at me. Thank you for waving at me. Thank you for waving at my son, you know, or my daughter, like that made the world to them. Like they play saxophone and they saw you and they were just, they can't stop talking about it. It's those little moments that those mean so much to me. I never take it for granted. And it's just, someone kind of pointed this out to me the other day, but when I told Kenny G, man, you're the reason I play saxophone, their response was, one day someone's going to say that because of you. And I'm like, whoa, like that's...
How does that feel for you?
Like, that almost, just thinking about it, kind of like makes me cry a little bit, or just like gets me like, wow, you know, because like, you never know the impact you have on someone, young or old. And obviously when you're young, you know, you're impressionable. You know, if I was a kid, I'd want to be like, you know, those guys on stage too, you know, like, I think that'd be amazing. I definitely have had a lot of those instances where I do connect with audience members and they do make it known to me. You know, I'm so grateful for those moments.
Does it hit you that, yes, it's a Jonas Brothers show, but there are people there in the audience to hear you play the sax? Is that something that you recognize at this point?
I mean, I don't know. It's a crazy thought. You know, mm-hmm. I obviously, like I said earlier, you know, I'm here to just support the brothers and you know, I'm lucky to just be a part of the band. I do love that, you know, they include us and you know, we are a band. That's the thing. I think the one thing about the Jonas Brothers is like, you know, Joe will always say, or, you know, Nick, like, oh yeah, me and the band. Mm-hmm. Like, it's always like the band. It's not just us. It's not just like me and the bros. I mean, this is our band. So they definitely show us a lot of love and I think fans get, they feel good being a part of that, and they feel good that, oh, it's like kind of like a family. It is a crazy thought. I hope no one solely comes for me. It is nice that they are there and they're seeing us and feeling our energy and our presence. So that makes me really happy.
Can you talk about the choreography aspect? Because you're there to play sax, and at the same time, there's a lot of choreography there. How do you prep for that when none of you are dancers, and yet there's movement and there's spinning and there's a lot going on there?
Yeah, it was just kind of one of the things that was expected of us when we got here. And I think as performers, we all managed to do it a little bit, some more than others, or some feel more comfortable than others. Initially, that was part of the gig. That was the understanding. Hey, we're not going to have dancers. The horn players and the guitar players and the background singers are the dancers. Like, you know, especially back when we had 4 background singers on that first tour, there was just a lot more people on stage. So there was a lot more going on, a lot more calculated moments of, okay, everyone be in a line here. Everyone switch here. Everyone do this. Everyone walk to their spots here. Everybody look out because the bros are going to be coming in this way and this way and that way. We had to work on it. We have a choreographer, and a large chunk of the learning curve is learning the steps and the movements and the blocking and when to go and when to not go. Mm-hmm. It's fun for me because I like you said, I'm not a professional dancer by any means, but it is fun to kind of get that little bit of opportunity to flex those muscles in a sense.
It seems like there's a lot of energy in it.
Oh, it's heavy to hold the sax, and yet you're also spinning with the sax, and there's a lot of talent in that alone.
Appreciate that, yeah.
We talked about some of your influences. Can you also, and you've had some pretty big collaborations, can you talk about who might still be bucket list artists for you that you would love to work with, whether it's studio or live in some form of collaboration?
Yeah, I would love to work with Stevie Wonder. That to me would be amazing. James Taylor would be another one that playing sax in his band would be. I went to go see him at the Hollywood Bowl with my dad, and it was just a legendary, legendary, legendary band. Steve Gadd on drums, Luis Conte on percussion, Larry Golding's on piano, many others I can't think of right now. Mm-hmm. But just an all-star band. I'd love to be on a Bruno Mars gig. I love Bruno Mars, man. I think that'd be really sweet.
Could put in some input into what guests can come for the last remaining shows.
I would love that. I mean, hey.
She'll want to know for Barclays.
I like it to be a surprise. For my last question, tell us a little bit about what's coming up for you musically in terms of anything that you might be releasing. You said that you have some music that might be coming out, any partnerships that you might be doing. Tell us what's next for you.
Definitely. I do have my next single coming out. It's called Shine a Little Love. And it's like a cool upbeat song. I got signed as an artist. Cool. As to MBF Entertainment, they're a smooth jazz label.
Awesome.
Under Adam Holly. And Adam Holly is a wonderful, wonderful artist, wonderful writer and producer. Man, this guy is in that world. He's just constantly on the radio, constantly writing number one hits for other people. And that's a really cool, fun thing. I think saxophone as an instrument, as a lead instrument, you know, doesn't have too many applications in the pop world. The lead instrument, like, obviously people want to hear things with vocals. As lovely as I think I sound on vocals, I'm not quite the singer as I'd hope to be. So I got to do it on saxophone. So this is a kind of like a really cool space to kind of have that, you know, modern, it's jazz, but it's upbeat and it's got like, you know, R&B and soul and funk vibes to it. It's not just straight ahead jazz, very serious, straight ahead jazz. It's like feel good music, you know? So that's always the one thing that I just love, you know, and I want to portrayed through my music is that feel good time. And so this next single definitely exemplifies that feel. You know, this song to me feels like I'm, you know, walking down the street, you know, bright sunny day, and I'm just like strolling with some friends. I'm gonna have like an amazing day. And so yeah, that's like the fifth of my, I've released five, that'll be my fifth single that I release in 2 years. And then I'm expecting maybe in the middle of next year for the whole album to come out. So that'll be the entire album, the five singles plus an additional five songs that haven't been released. And yeah, that's the goal. That's the goal. It's just to, you know.
Good for you.
Very cool.
Thank you.
For my last question, kind of diving into our area a little bit, we work with a lot of musicians for their in-ear monitors. And we find that horn players, wind players can oftentimes struggle with their in-ears and the way they sound to themselves. Can you talk about how professionally you've gotten adapted to using in-ears and maybe some of the things that you may not like about them and some of the things that you really find beneficial?
Definitely. I mean, I think for obviously what we're doing and the size of the production we're doing with the Jonas Brothers or something of that, you know, level, it is absolutely essential to be on in-ears. There's just no way. With all the sound vibrating off different places, you'll just be way thrown off, you know? So the use of the in-ear monitors is so beneficial in that respect. Even just, you know, it's funny. I think initially I used to put my in-ears pretty loud. And then one time, one of the frequencies, something was like rattling in there. And I was like, oh man, I don't know, you know, what happened. And the guy who got my ears, he was like, yeah, literally in the frequency range that a saxophone is in, it, like that's the drum that burst, or that's like the little driver that ruptured in your ears. Oh. He's like, so this is what I'll do. You can't be cranking your thing, man. Yeah. You got to turn it down. What I would do is turn it the least you can and manageable, and then just go up tiny from there. So that's kind of my rule of thumb now, because I've even heard guys too that are older than me that would play with like Luis Miguel and all these huge big acts back in the day, and they were like, dude, I messed up my hearing from having my in-ears too loud.
Yeah,
and it was counterproductive.
But hearing protection if you're driving a hell of a lot of intensity from them.
Exactly. So I'm very aware of that now, and I really am like super, super conscious of like, okay, it's getting too loud, let me turn it down. Because
and
it costs money, obviously, to fix those. And then just your hearing, you can't really fix that if you mess that up. So
exactly. Okay. One of the things we tell our artists is if you practice with them before tour and practice with them at a level that is a little bit lower than you may prefer, you will acclimate to that and use a softer intensity on stage that will protect your hearing in the long run.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I think it's great. I mean, especially when I played drums, I was just on a tour also playing drums. And I love that because if you have everything right in your mix, you don't have to like feel like you have to hit hard or overcompensate for something. You can just play normal. So I think it's beneficial because I used to not do that. And then, you know, you'd be just, you know, you'd have be sitting on a sub or have a sub right behind you and, you know, a giant speaker just blasting at your face and you're playing drums. And it's like, This is terrible.
Well, Fabian, we really appreciate you coming on to today. As Eric made it very clear, I'm a pretty big Jonas Brothers fan, but beyond them, it's fascinating to hear about it from the perspective of other musicians, because every piece contributes to make a wholesome show. And I've always thought your work was great in that. And it's been very cool to hear about it from you personally. So why don't you tell our listeners a bit about where they can find you, connect with you, and see more about your music and get updates from you?
Definitely. I'm very active on Instagram. You can find me on Instagram at Fabian Chavez Music. I actually have my website, fabianchavez.com. If you ever want to reach out or, you know, book me, you can find me there. And yeah, just, you know, on YouTube, I got some stuff, but mainly Instagram is where I'm pretty active. Also Spotify and Tidal and Apple Music, Fabian Chavez.
Perfect.
Awesome. So thank you, Fabian, so much for coming on Hear Us Out. We really appreciate you and taking the time with us.
And we'll see you at Barclay.
Got it. Amazing. Sounds great, you guys. Thank you for having me.